Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing in Cape Town there?
I'm very well, thank you indeed, Nick. Thank you.
And Ms. Sarah Gaughan. Sarah, how are you?
No, I'm well. Well, thank you.
Well, it's almost the end of the week, and it's the end of our show for this week. So let's start off with a fun story. And this was brought to my attention by Michael. And the headline is: a KZN resident plants banana trees in local potholes, which seems like an incredible lack of effort by headline writers considering, you know, goes bananas, stops Banana Republic. Anyway, we'll get onto that in a second. In frustration at the inaction of the Kwadakuza municipality in KZN to fill up huge potholes, a guy called Rishi Puran, who is a member of the Glen Hills District Civic Association, has begun planting banana trees in various potholes in the roads to raise the issue with the municipality that they are delivering poor service. According to Puran, the street has been plagued with water leaks that have contributed to damaged road surfaces, apparently by burst water pipes. After months of waiting for the municipality to fix the potholes, Puran took matters into his own hands. He said, "I challenge the community to do the same, to prove a point to the municipalities in the area. We've raised the issue so many times, but we still don't get proper service. Whenever you see a pothole, plant a tree, preferably a banana tree, as our town is now becoming a banana republic. Let's not sit back because our officials from the municipality don't drive in our areas. They live in estates that do not know the condition of our roads. Once they find all of the trees and all the potholes, maybe someone will take action." He's lived in the neighborhood for 20 years, and he says that him and his neighbors have been growing more frustrated over the past couple of years, the lack of service delivery. "We've been left high and dry," he said. "It seems to be up to us to do something about it. Maybe this will get our officials to take notice." The municipality responded saying, "Following reports that emanated media post, our technicians have visited the affected areas, and our findings were that there are burst pipes that the district municipality needs to fix before we can attempt to do any works. The matter was not reported to Kwadakuza municipality, so we wish to desist from any suggestion that we were told and kept quiet. We wish to place it on record that other potholes where there is no burst pipe issues have been attended to in the same community." That's what the municipality said. So, Banana Republic, bananas in potholes. Michael, is this a good thing? Do you think he's got the right idea? It's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an admirably imaginative response to clearly a problem of some long standing. And I mean, how telling, you know, that the municipality said this issue has not been reported to us, which, you know, clearly indicates that they're not properly aware of what's going on in the area that they're responsible for. So I think it's an absolutely wonderful thing. It's novel. It's going to get attention. It has no doubt already got the attention of the local officials, and I think all strength to him. I think it's a wonderful idea.
What's interesting to me about this story is how it's like a microcosm of so many of the problems with local government in one, particularly the municipality's response. So you said firstly that they said they haven't reported it, and I actually, having worked in local government a bit, that may be possible. A lot of people just don't know how to report issues to their municipality. But even worse than that, a lot of the reporting avenues, whether they be call centers or websites, are often broken or are not correctly connected to the people who the messages are supposed to go to. And so while the resident may have reported it, the infrastructure may not have actually sent it to the people who are supposed to fix the problem. And then we've got this other issue here, which is that the municipality doesn't seem to – that the district municipality is fighting with the local municipality over who's supposed to fix the issues. Mm. Sarah, is there anything that strikes you about this story, similar to what I've just said?
It's tragic comic, if I can put it that way. Let's put it this way. It highlights two things about South Africa. The one is appalling municipal management, and the wonderful ability for South Africans to be entrepreneurs about something. So I suspect they're going to have a plantation in the district before they have their roads fixed. But it is that serious. I mean, the state of municipalities in this country is really, really dire. And if you think that, you know, that's the political level at which most people experience politics and governance. The ANC should be very, very afraid for next year's election, because it seems as if all the governance, particularly of municipalities, sort of unravels after a certain period, say 20 years. And I think we've reached that point where skill has been replaced by no skill, and no skill has been replaced by no skill. And so that pattern is eventually caught up with the ability for municipalities to do anything. So it's actually an incredibly serious, serious issue.
One of the things our CEO, Frans Cronje, has talked about, he gives these scenarios for how the country might look in the future. And one of them is called the fragmentation scenario. And that basically is where the central authority of government just sort of disintegrates at the edges, and local powers that are not the sort of normal suspects take over in various areas around the country. And that ranges from everything from sort of gangsters to local populist politicians to gated communities, that kind of thing. And I think that what we're seeing here, this stunt is, I think, one that's being replicated across the country. You've seen in municipalities in places like the Free State, where I think it was in Harry Smith, where a guy I've actually met, called a farmer called Pietrus, took it upon himself to fix the local water pumping station, because the municipality refused to do it. And him and other people in the community got together, and they basically worked really hard to fix the pumping stations, get the water flowing back to the town. And there were lots of volunteers and stuff. And the city officials at first tried to stop them, but ultimately had to give up because they realized that there was nothing they could do to stop them. And so, in a sense, there are almost two governments in that town now. And we've seen that in other places too, where municipalities have run out of money and they're not being able to pay their Eskom bill. So the city gets cut off, or the town gets cut off from electricity, even though the residents have paid their rates. And I believe there's some court cases now where residents are saying to the municipalities, we should be able to pay the money direct to Eskom, not go through the municipality. Just a sort of final thought on this. Michael, do you think my analysis is correct? Do you think that we're beginning to see sort of an uprising of civil society against municipalities?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And of course, there are risks in citizens feeling that they are having to take over the job that they're paying officials to do. And I guess in this particular case, one of the things I especially like about it is that it compels something other than a kind of law and order response. It's harmless in a sense, but it's also unignorable. But it does actually demand somebody to do something in a way that doesn't result in, you know, millions of rands worth of damage to infrastructure and roads or whatever it might be. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. There is a feeling that people are sick and tired of the lack of action, and they are going out into the streets and doing things to either solve the problem or to very forcefully bring it to the attention of those who need to deal with the problems.
I think that's an excellent point about service delivery protests. Sorry, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say that, you know, South Africans have used to thousands of service delivery protests taking place in the last few years, where poorer communities have objected, you know, they haven't been serviced, or their council is corrupt, and those sort of issues. I think we're now at the stage where, in one form or another, almost everyone will be protesting against lack of service delivery. That's how bad it's become. It won't necessarily obviously be in the same way, but this banana plantation is certainly, as you say, it brings to attention in a way that the municipality cannot ignore. But it's getting into the more affluent, you know, the more affluent suburbs are starting to become part of the protesting movement.
Mm. Indeed, I definitely think that that it is spreading into the areas of South Africa that have been able to ignore some of these problems for a long time in the cities and that kind of thing. Although ultimately, I think that, you know, these protests will have limited effect unless people do actually either start paying their taxes to a different group, as in has been suggested in some of the municipalities, or alternatively, if they don't actually remove their leaders with the municipal leaders with a vote and hold the new ones to account.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is Sarah's point a bit earlier, that let's hope that next year we see evidence of voters making those kinds of decisions.
Precisely. Some of those municipalities where the water ran out, for example, I think that it is a bit of an indictment on the community if they vote back in exactly the same way as last time.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
Sure. Yeah.
And it doesn't mean necessarily you don't even have to vote for a party in municipal elections, because you can vote for independent candidates far more easily. So they could, you know, I'm sure there are alternatives. Anyway, let's move on now to a story that's making a lot of international news, and I think it's going around on social media. It's attracted the attention of pop stars and rappers and all sorts of celebrities, and that is the drama going on in Nigeria. So in the capital, Lagos, fires are currently burning, and several states have been placed under curfew due to unrest, resulting from protests that were launched on the 8th of October against a unit of the Nigerian police called the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS for short. Somewhat confusingly, it's not the South African Revenue Service. The Anti-Robbery Squad has been accused by human rights groups of extortion, harassment, torture, and murder. It was disbanded after only 3 days of protests on the 11th of October, but the protests have now persisted with calls for more law enforcement reform and have spread, and their demands have extended. The president, Muhammadu Buhari, has appealed for understanding and calm. Armed police are trying to enforce the curfew now. And since the protests began, 56 people have died across Nigeria, including 38 after the police shot allegedly at a crowd of protesters on Tuesday. Now, I've seen the videos that are evidence for the shooting, and it does seem pretty strong evidence that the police did shoot at them, although it is still technically disputed. Sarah, what should we make of these protests in Nigeria?
I think what's really interesting is that when Nigeria, in, say, the last decade has been in the news, it's either been about a presidential election, Boko Haram activity in the northeast, or the Delta, where all the oil refineries hold sway. This is probably the first time that I can remember offhand where Nigeria as a whole has been up in arms about an issue. And so it's gained a traction that sort of appears to cross all boundaries. But presumably its real social media impact has been because it's the sort of issue about which younger people will protest. It's a sign perhaps of the quality of policing in Nigeria, which we would understand, and it wouldn't be citizen friendly, shall we say, but there's enough democracy in Nigeria for this thing to snowball from one issue to the next, because it's classic. As soon as the government gives into a demand, there will be others. In other words, everyone's anger and frustration will come pouring out in a whole lot of other ways. So, and it doesn't appear that I've seen that it's sort of organized specifically by any other political grouping or people who are alternative power brokers in the society. So it's very much, I think we mentioned earlier, it's a sort of Hong Kong situation without the organization, certainly on the part of the police.
Right. And the other protest movement I would compare it to is, shall we say, the more moderate parts of the Black Lives Matter movement. So, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement, as we have chronicled in reports, is about a lot more than police. You know, it's founders of the Black Lives Matter Global Network are sort of avowed Marxists with their own ideological agenda. But the reason that so many people got behind the movement to support it this year, I think, is certainly because of this issue of police reform. Michael, what do you make of that? Do you think I'm right on that? That's cool.
Yes, I certainly think so. I mean, for me, it underlines the fragility of government credibility under conditions of stress, very broadly speaking. But really, just how important it is in any society for politicians to be accountable, to respond to pay attention to citizens much more immediately than they're perhaps accustomed to doing. And it also, I think, brings home two other things. One is that, you know, law and order solutions are not always the solutions to law and order problems. Clearly this unit in Nigeria was set up to deal with crime, but itself then became a problem. And we've seen this elsewhere in the world. And the point that Sara made, which I think is especially important, is that, you know, the intensity of these things is made all the more so in an age when communication is in the hands of people, you know, literally on their cell phones. It's very immediate, and the swift international response is an indication of that. It's, you know, things can't be localized and contained, kept secret. Nothing can be kept under wraps because it just gets out immediately. And I think we certainly saw that in the protests in America and elsewhere, and similarly in Hong Kong. So it's a big challenge to modern governments to respond credibly and with good sense to issues that the people raise.
It's also, I think, and I said this slightly before the show, it's an example of what maybe Black Lives Matter would look like if it wasn't so suffused with race issues. Because, of course, in Nigeria, you know, the government is black, the majority of people are black. There's no, that whole racial aspect is not there. There may, of course, be some ethnic, tribal politics going on there. But I think, by and large, that's largely absent.
Yes.
And as a result, I suspect the movement it's already been more successful than Black Lives Matter has, precisely because it's focused on an actual, very tangible issue that you can deal with very directly. Complaining about like racism in general or structural racism, like there's so few obvious policy prescriptions for that. Whereas in this case, there is a police unit that's killing people. That's something you can do something about. Sara, do you agree with me?
I do. In fact, it sort of sums up the crass dishonesty of the Black Lives Matter movement, because as you said, it's very political. Its founders follow a Marxist line. They want to overthrow capitalism, etc. And all the research that has come out during this period, while the protests have been going on, has established the opposite of what the Black Lives Matter movement has alleged, and that's sort of systemic racism in police departments, the fact that, in fact, more whites are likely to be shot by police than blacks, et cetera, et cetera. This is the real deal. And I think, we would treat it to some extent with the respect it deserves. Perhaps it was also what you have to bear in mind is the sheer image of imposing a curfew on Lagos. I mean, that's like imposing a curfew on America. You know, it's so huge and should be unwieldy. I don't think it'll last for 10 minutes. But as I say, the credibility here is that the issue and the issues are real. They do not specifically serve just a leftist policy agenda.
Michael, do you have any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. You know, it's a focus on a concrete rather than an abstract grievance, and again, in a way, a bit like our banana man, it's drawing attention to something which people want fixed. Rather than to a general sort of ideological sensibility. So it makes it all the more difficult for anyone to ignore. Calls for some sharp thinking from the authorities in Nigeria.
Definitely agree with that. Sorry, do you have any final thoughts to add here?
Not really. No, that's largely been said.
Cool. And let us hope that Nigeria is able to resolve some of these issues, and that the government is responsive to what people are saying. And also that no more people get shot by the cops, because of, 56 people is, that's what, twice Marikana
nearly,
in the space
of
a week? Yeah. So anyway, hopefully such a peace returns to Nigeria soon, as well as reform. Let's move on to now a story about the DA. So the DA is, I think our campaign, our deputy head of policy, Herman Pretorius, would say that they were cribbing from our worksheet here. But the DA has urged on all South Africans to write to their bank to tell them to stop funding SAA. So they explained in a media statement, they said, part of the reason that SAA has been able to continue this long is thanks to the massive loans extended to SAA by South Africa's major banks. All of these loans are guaranteed by the government and therefore by the public, who eventually will have to pay them back. It's just a bailout by stealth. The extension of these loans is not ethical business practices by major banks. They know they will turn an easy profit on a guaranteed loan to a company that would never ordinarily qualify. This too must stop. As part of our effort to mobilize public pressure, they are launching an online effort to get all South Africans to write to their bank to demand they stop all further support for SAA. So, of course, we've written to banks about similar issues to do with their cooperation with EWC or financial firms with their cooperation with prescribed assets. So from my perspective, it looks like a pretty good campaign. But Sarah, what do you make of this?
I think it's an interesting campaign from two points of view. The one is that the banks have tended to get away with the SAA issue. It's, in other words, it's the government goes to the banks agree terms and they've got loans. I know as I understand it, the banks have sort of been a little less encouraged lately to hand over the money. But if you think about it, basically the government's saying, we want a loan on behalf of the people of South Africa to keep SAA alive, even though South Africa doesn't really want it to be kept alive, and the loan will be paid back with interest in due course. So, in other words, it's just an obligation on a very beleaguered society to loan and repay large amounts of money for something it doesn't want. And I think Jordan Hill Lewis, the Shadow Minister of Finance for the DA, has put it quite boldly. He says, stop all further bailouts of SAA. It is simply immoral to cut essential public services to fund yet another bailout for SAA. Between schools and SAA, choose schools. Between hospitals and SAA, choose hospitals. Between fighting crime and SAA, choose fighting crime. And I would say between public transport that serves a much larger number of South African citizens and poorer compared to the sort of elite that uses aeroplanes. The fact that our train service is in such appalling condition that makes this unbelievable. And they persist with the dishonesty of saying we need an airline to encourage our tourism growth. And the answer is we do not. There are international airlines who would pick up the slack, who have better sort of situated currently to do so. So I think there's some merit to this campaign, and it's getting people involved, and you can do it whichever way you like, but they're at least encouraging it.
Michael, before the show, you said that this theme running through all the stories we've talked about today is government not really responding to people's demands. Are we seeing the same thing here?
I think so. I mean, I think there is this quite an interesting theme. In a way, it's a theme of politicians and activists and so on making the case that politics is more than voting in elections. It's taking a stand on day-to-day issues. In this particular case, it's telling corporate South Africa, it's very much, as you mentioned, a theme of the IRR's campaigning, that it's part of the issue. It's part of this vital conversation about where we're going as a society. Business, the business of business is somewhat more than simply business, particularly when it impinges on the lives of ordinary people. And this in conditions, post-lockdown conditions, where jobs and salaries are threatened, people are feeling immense pressure. And I think it's the perfect time to bring attention to corporate South Africa that the people they depend on, the clients, are expecting better decisions and more principled and forceful decision making in their boardrooms.
Exactly, and I think and this is why the IRR keeps bringing it up. When the corporate sector plays along with government in the way that it's been doing on SA and the way it's possibly doing on EWC and the way that it's also been doing on prescribed assets, what it does is it creates options for government to ignore the core problems. It provides space to avoid reform. And we've seen this with SAA, which really, as we've said before on the show, is the thin end of the wedge. Because if something as obviously unnecessary as SAA can't be reformed, then there isn't much hope for reforming much else of the economy. Sara, do you agree with that point?
Yes, I do. As I say, I mean, there may be arguments to make for SAA, but that would be making arguments in an environment where so much else isn't wrong. We're comfortably off. We don't have to fight for the money. We don't have to make odious choices. And there is so much there are so many reasons why not to do it in the circumstances. And I think I agree with Michael. I think this is about politics, the politics of the people.
Right, and we wouldn't have to bail out SAA so much if it made money. And while it is rare, and while obviously we all think that SAA should be privatized, there are actually state airlines around the world and even in Africa that have been able to turn a profit. And I'm thinking here of Ethiopian Airlines, which despite going through incredibly dysfunctional autocratic regimes, managed to retain this core of competent officials who actually, it was the one part of the government that actually ran. Sorry, there was actually a plane that just flew over the
top. Yeah, I heard it.
not SAA, I
sounds smaller.
Probably. So I wonder how much longer the government really is going to keep funding empty planes with no one on them, which is what we've seen from SAA.
Can I just add that the really appalling thing, and I read it, I don't know who said it, but it was kind of said in the disbelief, is that anyone who could have appointed Dudu Mieni to run SAA was heading us right down the rabbit hole. Because when you were a mere youth, SAA did turn a profit. Its failure to turn a profit has happened over the last 9 or 10 years. So, you can't have 9 times the opportunity to fail. You give it up.
Right. And the kind of shocking thing to me here also about SAA is how we all thought, I think a month or two ago, that SAA would be done, but the government was going to do this completely mad scheme to resurrect it again as a, what is it that R.W. Johnson
Phoenix.
Said? A dodo from the ashes.
Yes.
And yet somehow it's still going. It's still managing to creep on. It's like...
Yes.
It has the secret to eternal life. Anyway, let's start wrapping up here. Michael, any final thoughts on this?
Really, just to emphasize the point that you made a little earlier, that the government will continue to do these crazy things so long as it feels it has a kind of backstop position of a more or less pliant corporate environment, people who are willing to continue funding them and so on. And, all praise to citizen activism, which is very likely to put pressure on them to change that.
Exactly. Sara, any final thoughts?
Just a question. Could it be that SAA is going to desperately want to be resurrected so that members of parliament can carry on having free flights? Is that possibly what it's all about?
So I'm slightly skeptical of that idea, because I think that the ANC members of parliament don't actually have a lot of input into the party beyond the sort of ministers. Remember that a significant number actually voted against Zuma back during towards the end of his presidency in that vote of no confidence, which I think shocked the ANC, and I think that shows really that, you know, that they are not a powerful part because the ANC has so centralized power in the party. I think they've really hurt Parliament's ability to, even with the ANC members of Parliament's ability to actually influence politics, which is a terrible thing indeed. I don't know. Do you guys agree with me on that point? Mm.
It is a terrible thing. And, you know, but on the other hand, there's nothing wrong with the parliamentarians communicating by Zoom and Microsoft Teams like the rest of us.
Although my father, who is an MP, has pointed out that there's much less good heckling that gets done.
Oh, yes.
I can imagine.
You can dispatch them electronically.
Yeah, it gives the speaker's chair a lot more option to prevent people from interjecting or asking questions.
Yes, of course.
Anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week and have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.